All right, so I guess I'll just dive right in to make sure that you get all the good stuff. So social ontology's purpose is to outline the mechanisms that ground and maintain the social world, the social world being the world of intersubjective achievements, including everything from friendships to governments, artifacts to economies. Theories of collective intentionality offer a promising approach to establishing a social ontology. They work from the assumption that sociality is predicated on our capacity to act together, that intentions in the we form function to establish social practices and ground the deontic statuses and powers social objects have. Such an approach has the further benefit of not being entirely anthropocentric, though in the present case, I'm only concerned with humans. Three principal voices of mainstream collective intentionality are John Searle, Michael Bratman, and Mark Gilbert. Each offers their own account of sociality and collective intentionality. Searle argues that we intentions do all the work. This is a gross gloss, of course. Bratman offers a planning theory of social action, and Gilbert offers a theory of joint commitments. What each of these has in common is that they assume cooperation is fundamental to sociality. Bratman and Gilbert building shared intentions with meshing subplans or jointly being committed to acting together in unison into their respective accounts. Searle's account requires only that we each share and act upon intentions for acting together, Searle even asserting that instances of competition are actually fundamentally cooperative as well, his examples being a game of chess or a boxing match. So collective intentionality theories don't just claim that this is how social action ought to function, but go further in asserting that this is how social actions do function. A social ontology is to be judged, though, in relation to, not to whether the norms it offers are possible and consistent with other normative or metanormative considerations, but in relation to how well it accounts for possibilities of social action. As such, any social ontology which fails to account for genuine possibilities or actualities of social action fails in its task. And injustice isn't merely possible, it's actual. As Charles Mills has noted, quote, sexism and racism, patriarchy and white supremacy have not been the exception, but the norm. As such, any social ontology unable to account for the possibility of injustices large and small is in need of critique. Social ontology that's premised exclusively on cooperative modes of human interaction has insurmountable problems, adequately accounting for oppression and other forms of injustice. At best, such views can only count oppression as anomalous. At worst, such a view cannot even recognize oppression at all. So for purposes of time, I shall only identify in passing four problems I think mainstream theory has, or problematic views it has, then offer a summary gloss of Sartre's social ontology. I still argue that Sartre's social ontology has the capacity to avoid the problems of mainstream theory. It's an assumption of this paper that Sartre's account can be identified as a collective intentional approach. So my aim is not to abandon collective intentionality, but to radically reform it, make it phenomenologically rich, if you will. So those four views that are problematic of mainstream theory or four problematic assumptions are as follows. First, for mainstream theory, everything social is actively planned. Second, for mainstream theory, everything social is planned in cognizance of what we intend. Ignorance is precluded. Thirdly, injustice either shouldn't exist or is at best anomalous in mainstream theory's social world. And fourthly, subjects have no meaningful identities in mainstream theory, even though our identities are historically and culturally formed social facts. Okay. So at the outset, Sartre addresses mainstream theory's third problem. He argues that a social ontology must be able to account for the formal structural conditions of alienation and other forms of injustice, of individual praxis, and the conditions which encourage the constitution of common praxis. In a footnote, he adds that to do so, one must engage in, quote, the dialectical investigation of alienation as an a priori possibility of human praxis on the basis of real alienation to be found in concrete history. Theories that abstract away from actual historical and human engagements and focus on some ideal of human interaction are thus incapable of recognizing even the possibility of alienation or systemic injustice. Alienation, isn't an abstract result of human nature any more than it is a product of things themselves. It arises through how human interactions with one another and things function in real relations. Praxis originate as a negation of one's situation, a reaction to our basic human vulnerability. As needs express themselves, one acts so as to respond to the needs themselves. We establish social praxis originally in response to real or perceived needs, and when a manner of interacting with one another becomes habitual, that is part of the fabric of our social lives, one is able to ignore its functional nature and forget its historical origins, all while the norms therein continue as practice. Sartre goes so far as to argue that, quote, within modern culture as a whole, my knowledge must be dialectically conditioned by my ignorance. Yet on analysis, we cannot ignore the relations and conditions that enable practices. For Sartre, there is freedom only in a situation, and there is a situation only through freedom. In the section entitled Reciprocity, Exploitation, and Repression, Sartre argues a reciprocal ternary is the basis for all social relations. Bona fide reciprocity requires, according to Sartre the Third, it isn't possible in dyadic relations, as the earlier Sartre and mainstream theory each believe. Sartre argues, and this is a long quote, a binary formation as the immediate relation of man to man is the necessary ground for any ternary relation. But conversely, a ternary relation as the mediation of man amongst men is the basis on which reciprocity becomes aware of itself as a reciprocal connection. This trinity is not a designation or ideal mark of the human relation. It is inscribed in being, that is to say, in the materiality of individuals. It is the lived relations whose contents is determined in a given society and which are conditioned by materiality and capable of being modified only by action. End quote. It is the Third who makes a situation genuinely social. The Third validates the relations between individuals, and it is because of the Third that Sartre insists the meanings of our relations and our actions transcend us as individuals. It is not sufficient that I ascribe given meaning to my action. It is important how others identify the significance of my actions, as that is how they are received and where their social significance is found. I cannot dictate social significance of my actions, only recognize them and attempt to get others to modify their uptake. So Sartre offers additional observations to how reciprocity functions. For one, Sartre denies that reciprocity is always something equivalent to treating others as fully equal moral subjects in their own right. It is instead recognition of one's subjectivity. So one might be recognized as a subject only so far, or as some deviant form of subject. Recognition isn't a recognition of one's subjectivity in full moral weight. Hence Sartre's denial that he's proposing anything like Kant's Kingdom of Ends as a social ontology. Mainstream theory's form of reciprocity is a reciprocity related to the content of shared action or shared goal, either as a reciprocity in the relation of content to the content itself, or in relation to one's recognition that the other and oneself agree to that content, at least in broad outline. Second, recognition comes in both positive and negative forms. Third, Sartre argues that partial recognition is no objection to the exploitation and or oppression of individuals. That one is recognized in a given capacity is not evidence that one is not being subjected to injustice. Hence Sartre's argument that neither reciprocity nor ternary relations themselves are totalizing. Instead, they are multiple adhesions between men which keep society in a Coelian state. It's a cool metaphor that Sartre cooked up there. Sociality is a process happening in respect of many praxis overlapping at once, holding together tenuously through our engagements. Where any social field is constituted very largely by structured ensembles of groupings which are always both praxis and practico inert, although either of these characteristics may constantly tend to cancel itself out, end quote. All social engagements are constituted either by active praxis undertaken in cognizance, or, as is true in most cases, the sedimented praxis embedded in the codified social expectations and norms of a given sociocultural locale. Crucially for Sartre, social relations are layered in mediations, always mediated by others and historically formed background conditions. Those background conditions often include bad faith practices and color our engagements with bad faith norms. For example, the habit of men talking over and interrupting their female colleagues is a background habit or norm that expresses the disvalue of women's voices and their subjectivity. On Sartre's view, it is important to expose such practices so that we might attempt to establish alternatives. So mainstream theory, though, has no real resources for examining mediating influences, as it can account for only, one, the agents themselves, two, their intentions related to the given project, and three, their immediate action, sort of taken in isolation. The context of our acting is ignored in mainstream theory, even though it is the material condition for our actions in the world. Yet the contexts one out want to operate within are themselves products, of the interaction between human practices and the material world. Engagements with practical objects of everyday concern are really acts of resuscitating embedded praxis, actionable intentional formations whose cultural presence is passively operative. The formation and maintenance of cultural and social habits is an activity, an inherently social activity. No one of us could affect it alone. This social activity is not something that mainstream theory can model effectively, yet it should as a social ontology. Sartre argues, quote, the synthetic unification of a habitat is not merely the labor which has produced it, but also the activity of inhabiting it. It is in living forms of life, and in our continued intersubjective recognitions of meanings, being what they are, that we form the habits and habitats of social engagement, what Sartre calls the practical field. Since the practical field of intersubjective engagements and expectations is the backdrop against which one undertakes individual or collective action, and it itself is a product of collective actions, ignoring it is a wrong-headed approach to social ontology. In Sartrean terms, we might say that mainstream theory has put the cart before the horse by taking group action as prior to sociality and not the reverse, or more accurately still, in Sartre's own case, as not recognizing adequately that it's dialectically entangled with one another. The practica inert, though, is at least as important to understand as group actions, if not more so. So a condition of any praxis for Sartre is comprehension. By that, Sartre means a basic awareness of that which one is doing and to what end. That is not to argue that awareness includes global understanding or full transparency of one's motives. It is only to assert that praxis cannot be undertaken without intention, and intention cannot be without awareness of that which is intended, in this case, an action. The assertion is that one is minimally aware of the general purpose of those actions one undertakes. One is generally aware of the aim of one's doings. Thus, Tom Flynn argues, quote, the truncated ignorance known as bad faith can infect anyone whose knowledge at the reflective or theoretico-practical level does not conform to his pre-reflective or practico-theoretical, that is, serial knowledge. This is the sort of systemic or serially collected bad faith that is present whenever one engages in an action that one knows generally contributes to injustice, but discounts or ignores one's own case. For example, I might know that sweatshop labor makes most of the clothes that I can purchase in the marketplace. However, when buying new clothes for myself, I might ignore that fact or dismiss my purchase's effects as minimal or inconsequential, as my aim is just to purchase new clothing for myself. Awareness of my aim can be dissociated from knowledge of my effects and my participation in broader injustice. Sartre recognizes at least three different kinds of social groupings: practico-inert or serial engagements, which he identifies as collectives; groups, first fused and then pledged; and finally, organizations and institutions. The collective, Sartre says, is the common existence of men insofar as they are individuals living side by side and yet without a feeling of community. In our serial engagements, we don't necessarily robustly recognize individual subjects in our shared engagements. We register one another's presence intersubjectively, often as role players relative to our practical inert expectations. As Flynn has it, within our collective forms of life, imitation or contagion, not cooperation, is the rule, interchangeability and numerical equivalence, not uniqueness. Sartre's paradigmatic example is a set of persons waiting at a bus stop together. They don't experience themselves as waiting in the form of a group, but they nonetheless recognize one another as waiting together. Since they are not waiting as a group, merely alongside one another, particular individuals are fungible to the situation. Sartre calls this a direct serial engagement. This is in contrast with what he calls indirect serial engagements, like a live radio broadcast. A live program or webcast, if we want to update the example, isn't something one experiences as just for oneself. It is for an abstract but an unknown sum of others. Collectives are contrasted with groups. And in one place, Sartre puts the distinction as follows, quoting, the group is defined by its undertaking and by the constant movement of integration which tends to turn it into pure praxis by trying to eliminate all forms of inertia from it. The collective is defined by its being, that is to say, insofar as all praxis is constituted by its being as mere exis, end quote. Groups proper require active engagement with others in response to some material conditions. We are doing something together. Collectives are inert forms of being engaged in some praxis alongside one another. Collectivity doesn't require our working together at all, where groups do. Where collectives involve a form of passive activity, groups require action proper. In a group, we take up a common praxis, In Flynn's analysis, it is a reciprocity that's mediated by praxis that sets groups apart. Sartre distinguishes two types of groups, what he calls groups in fusion and pledged groups. Groups in fusion arise out of seriality when a feeling of community emerges in response to some change in our material conditions. Sartre's example is the emergence of a threat to our well-being, one that binds us together in a responsive action. Groups in fusion are contrasted with pledged groups insofar as the former's union functions merely at a pre-reflective level. The difference, Sartre tells us, is between a group which posits itself for itself and the passivity of the practico-inert field. Pledged groups are those which we establish as part of our common praxis, in which we establish as part of our common praxis a reflexive recognition of the group as such. The lack of reflexive awareness of the group's identity in fused groups is not inconsistent with the experience of being in a group. Rather, it's a shift from nascent abstract awareness to express concrete awareness that marks the move from fused to pledged groups. Pledged groups become organizations once they begin to formalize or delegate roles related to the group's preservation across its members. For Sartre, an institution is formed when a group's own preservation takes on its own importance. This is something distinctive from our interest in the pursuit of our projects in common. So for Sartre, it means that the group's preservation is dissociated from that of its members. It has an inertia of its own. Any individual member, then, is dischargeable, where she undermines the group's perpetuation. Manifestations of sovereignty, authority, and bureaucracy are all representative of institutions. In a group, sovereignty over one's action and being is still one's own. The institution modifies that through use of its organizational structure to impose conditions that restrict one's actions and freedoms. What one can do is now dictated to one by another. One's membership in the institution is less one's own choice and now subject to the authority of another. One must now answer to others who have been granted authority in virtue of their role within the institution's organizational structure. One might think of the sort of shift in the group in the following manner. Groups serve our collective interest in undertaking some practice together. Institutions invert that order. Individuals serve the institution. Hence, Sartre's thinking that institutions begin to work back into the practico-inert, their activities become passive operations in the service of itself or themselves. The modern corporation and the cultural norms surrounding it seem to be paradigmatic examples of Sartrean institutions. Things get more complicated when one recognizes how the same sort of practices might be mediated through all three types of sociality at once. So Sartre's own example is that of labor. Practices surrounding labor are both practico-inert and institutionalized. A labor force, a set of laborers of a certain kind, are themselves a collective or a series. A specific set of laborers on one work site can function as a group, but often also within an institutional or organizational framework. In closing, Sartre's social ontology has shown itself capable of avoiding the pitfalls of mainstream theory. Sartre's inclusion of the practico-inert at the outset guarantees that he will be able to account for passive activities or those collective engagements which manifest their intentionalities horizontally. As for ignorance, Sartre's approach has a two-pronged response. First, ignorance is simply a feature of the practico-inert world itself. Second, Sartre can appeal to the phenomenon of bad faith. Bad faith begins to supply a response to the third set of problems, those of injustice, but Sartre doesn't presuppose that our social activities are inherently cooperative nor competitive. Instead, he recognizes from the beginning that bad faith engagements, alienation, exploitation, etc., are real parts of human history. As such, social injustices aren't anomalous for Sartre the way they are for mainstream theory. Given that, he will be able to redress and rebuke them. Finally, our identities are products of the historical relations between subjects through the motive being for others. In the critique, Sartre robustly develops the mediation of the third and argues forcibly that it is a reciprocal ternary that forms the basis for sociality, not the reciprocated binary. Our relations are mediated through others' experiences if they are to be social at all. Mainstream theory still functions in the model of the binary of you and I, each doing something together, closed off from others.